Welcome to the Free Dev Cafe, episode 135 with Juani Valdivia. My name is Donnie. I'm the host of the Free Dev Cafe. The Free Dev Cafe is the long-form interview podcast that explores the backstories, the training, the challenges, and the combined wisdom and personal philosophies of the world's free divers. You can find this podcast on the main website at freedivecafe.com, and you can also find it on all good podcast players such as Spotify, Google Podcasts, etc. For free diving news and deep dives into topics such as free diving lifestyle and science, check out the sister podcast to this one, the Free Diving Journal podcast. That one is at freediveandthrive.com/journal. And there is also the YouTube channel. Search for Free Dive and Thrive, where I'm regularly posting videos and video versions of the interviews and things like that. And Free Dive and Thrive is the home base for everything I do as a free diving instructor, coach, video maker, and podcaster. That's where to go to find out about courses and workshops that I am teaching. I'm currently in Dahab, Egypt. I'm here for 5 more weeks. If you want to do a course, get in touch. And after that, I'll be back in Taiwan for a while. Would be great to have you there too if the Chinese haven't invaded yet. On today's episode of the Free Dev Cafe, we are joined by returning guest Juani Valdivia. Juani was originally on the show on episode 99, where we found out about his backstory and we talked a little bit about free diving medicine. Juani is originally from Peru, now living in Florida in the USA, working as a neurosurgeon. Juani is also a competitive free diver. He's currently at VB at the time of this recording. Massive good luck to him. I see he's shooting for another national record today. I think it's 70 meters. Constant weight. So massive good luck to him there with all his dives. I enjoyed watching his new national record for Peru a couple of days ago. He's also heavily involved in free diving medicine, the furthering of the understanding, the science we have about medical and safety issues related to free diving. And that's what we're going to be getting deeper into today. Excuse me, my little kitty cat has just jumped onto my thigh with the full force of its claws. Hey buddy, how you doing? Okay, you go and chill out there beside all the wires and all the fancy equipment. There you go. Yeah, and of course, you know, like I mentioned there, Vertical Blue, the most prestigious of free diving competitions, is happening right now. And a couple of days after VB ends, there will be the IDA World Championships taking place in Roatan. So if you want to hear about all the most interesting dives, and there have already been quite a few interesting dives in VB. Hey, buddy. Oh, Jesus. Excuse, I can't just start the recording again. He'll settle down in a second. If you want to hear about all the most interesting dives from these two competitions, then be sure to check in with the Free Diving Journal news dispatch that should be coming out around the first couple of days of September. Is this August? Oh my God, yes, August. Before we get to the interview, let me just remind you that all of this, these two podcasts and the Free Dev and Thrive YouTube channel, are made possible by the kind support of patrons. I usually spend about 20 to 30 hours a week producing this material. It's an unpaid, pretty much a full-time job. It's a labor of love, but I very, very much appreciate the Patreon supporters and the donations they provide. If you would like to, the cat is trying to maul my hand now. If you would like to be a member of the Patreon family and support me in this endeavor, please consider joining the team. Patrons get extended versions of episodes, some special extra episodes, some other perks like discounts on courses if you take them with me. And of course, most importantly, a warm, fuzzy feeling inside knowing that you're helping. You can become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/freedivecafe. And a little bit of news for the Patreon family. If you haven't seen it on your Patreon dashboard yet, I released 2 days ago the first ever official solo sode. So this is me rambling and musing about what's going on with me right now, about life in Dahab, about having COVID and recovering, about how that's affected my free diving. I've broken down my training sessions dive by dive, explaining, you know, why I did it like that and what the results have been for the last week. I'm planning to release these solosodes every 2 weeks. So if you want an extra, 45 minutes of content and don't mind listening to me for that amount of time, then sign up and become a patron. I'm also putting my book recommendations in there, which a lot of people like as well. And also, if you are a patron and you have any questions that you want to ask of me to answer on that solosode, then feel free to get in touch. It could be a question about freediving, a technical question as a student, or it could be just some fun question. And a special thanks to new patrons and a goodbye to patrons who are leaving. And thank you to everyone who supports the show by listening or in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. All right, let's head over to the Freediving Cafe and settle down once again with Juani Valdivia to talk about freediving medicine. Let's dive.
It's rainy here in my city. You can see it on the back. It's really overcast and raining. So
well, nice. I like a little bit of tropical rain. Are you back in Florida?
Yep, I'm in Florida. Yeah.
Yeah. So I spoke to you last week, and you were at Dean's Blue Hole, and now you're back in Florida, and then you'll be shooting off back to Dean's Blue Hole in the not too distant future. And you're going to VB this year, Juani, aren't you?
Yeah, I am again, and just trying to do the best to train, you know? Sorry, just charging my computer, and between work and training, trying to get the best out of it.
Yeah, no, total respect to you for attempting, trying, managing to squeeze in training for Vertical Blue in between also being a neurosurgeon. You don't get much opportunity to train in Florida, right, in terms of depth?
No, but we have the springs here. We have some springs close by. You can get 40 meters in one of them max, and then another one you can get 50 perhaps more, with some safety concerns. But yeah, you can get some depth. In the Gulf, you cannot get much unless you go 40 miles out, and then you can get 45 meters perhaps. Slightly more. So you have to count your blessings, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere has its advantages and disadvantages, and nowhere is perfect. I mean, I'm sure everybody would love to be training in Dean's Blue Hole or in Dahab at the Blue Hole, but then you have always the downside of the environment, the lack of facilities, or the culture, or the heat, or whatever it is. There's always something. So count your blessings, as you say. Getting you back on this time, spoken to you a few times now, Juani. You were on the Freediving Cafe back in episode 99. And we discussed, we discussed your story, and we discussed a few other aspects of the medical side of free diving. You were recently on the Free Diving Journal podcast. We did a science episode looking at a study, the fMRI brain scans of Guillaume Nery and static apnea, which was awesome. And I interviewed Guillaume, I think, the same week. And I did say I was going to ask him about that. But to be honest, I was too busy being kind of like in awe of Guillaume and how cool he was that I didn't have the presence of mind to ask him
that's fine.
That question. And he more than adequately filled up the time himself, the whole 2 hours. So, the last few times that we've spoken, I've had you, you've mentioned about how excited you are about the new developments in freediving medicine and what kind of, what you are doing, what actions you're taking on, what you're involved in to improve the field of freediving medicine. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And then we're also going to look at some specifics of things like conditions that we encounter as freedivers, such as, decompression sickness or AGE, arterial gas embolism. We'll talk about squeezies a little bit. I'll ask you a couple of questions about squeezies and medications and stuff like that. And then anything else that you wish to bring up. But you've been talking a lot recently about freediving medicine. What have you been busy with in general on this topic?
First of all, thank you so much for giving me time and inviting me to your program. So I feel like I can only speak really from the medical standpoint. And I feel like the topic of prevention is huge. I don't know all the ways to prevent freediving incidents since I've had myself a handful. But I feel like in the future, prevention of freediving incidents, freediving related incidents such as blackout or lung barrel trauma, but going beyond that, issues related to medications, for example, or recent past medical history are going to be important since freediving is supposed to be increasing numbers and it's going to explode in the next 5 years, perhaps. So more people are going to start taking freediving courses that are, let's say, over 65 years old or have past medical history of either hypertension or diabetes or COPD or pulmonary issues. And then you wonder how they're going to be if now you're going to have older students and more students with past medical issues. So I feel like prevention is going to be a huge topic coming up. Students are not going to be just young, fit, sort of explorer type students in pre-diving. You're going to be having the other population of students, you know, more maybe retired students or older. I feel like prevention is a huge topic.
Okay, so we can talk a little bit about the different kinds of conditions. You did mention a few of them there. Some that will become more, that are more prevalent in older populations or populations that are sicker or have pre-existing conditions and things like that. But also, I guess all of these conditions could also be encountered in younger, healthier divers, depending on the situation and their personal conditions. You know, let's just, for the listeners, try to sort of make a little simple list here of the main conditions and accidents or circumstances that we might encounter as a free diver that need to be addressed with free diving medicine. One of those, of course, would be, for example, lung barrel trauma. Another one would be decompression sickness. What would you add to that list?
Well, lung barrel trauma, or respiratory barrel trauma, which includes upper respiratory barrel trauma and then lung barrel trauma, are going to be always there because people are going to continue to free dive, including myself, and I'm sure I may have another incident of that. And decompression sickness is something that has to be put on the horizon when people are getting deeper and deeper. Now, the literature describes that you can have decompression sickness even with depths of 33 feet, you know, 10 meters. But I feel like the more, when you see the list of records, world records in the last couple of years, the depths are just deeper and deeper and deeper. So I feel like the physiology, human physiology, is getting pushed to the limit, and therefore the risk of decompression sickness will be always there. Another big topic is going to be just your run-of-the-mill blackout, what we call blackout in medicine, freediving related syncope. So that's going to be, I feel like that's going to be something to consider, especially soon that, I don't know, it seems like the horizon is showing that freediving is just going to be more prevalent and more popular in the next year or two. So the idea is that to avoid incidents on the backyard pool, for example, if somebody wants to try and imitate somebody in on a video and blacking out on a pool. So prevention on that is huge, and I feel it's a public health issue that is going to be, a concern of any country in any community. Another issue is medications. I feel like more and more freedivers are going to start taking classes or get deeper while on medications. For example, medications are be a concern. Diuretics, if one is taking diuretics, makes you in a negative balance of water, then freediving also will produce diarrhea. So you have to be careful using diuretics while freediving or while having long sessions of freediving or freediving for many, many days in a row. Beta blockers too, for patients that are older and have hypertension, beta blockers can actually produce bradycardia and lower your blood pressure. And if you sum that up to the effects of dive reflex and blood shift, you have more bradycardia and perhaps even hypotension. So that's a concern. Any alpha blockers as well that may interfere with vasoconstriction may potentially interfere with the dive reflex mechanism, which includes peripheral vasoconstriction. So that's another one, another medication of possible concern. And always, I feel like I'm always concerned of blood thinners, anticoagulants, which is a big range from either aspirin to the most concerning ones, such as Pradaxa, Xarelto, etc. Those the problem with this is you may not have any symptoms by taking the blood thinners because it may be indicated for blood clots or a heart stent. However, if you have, let's say, you're bleeding from your nose or sinus bleeding from a mask squeeze or a sinus squeeze or even tracheal squeeze, if you have that on blood thinners, then that bleeding may be much worse and it may turn into a much more serious situation, such as airway compromise or aspiration pneumonia, or God forbid something else like hemothorax or something like that. So blood thinners are very, at least in my mind, a big concern. And so let's say a diver has a minor issue, like a mild tracheal squeeze or a mild lumbar trauma. If you're on blood thinners, you could bleed more, theoretically. And that happens in surgery. If you have an incision or a cut and you're in blood thinners, you can bleed a lot more and can turn into a disaster. So some blood thinners can be reversed. Like if you have taking aspirin, they give you something to revert the aspirin effect, like platelet transfusion. If you're taking Coumadin, for example, you get fresh frozen plasma, or Kcentra, which is a medication that reverses Coumadin pretty fast. But if you're taking other blood thinners, such as Eliquis or more of the newer generation of blood thinners, those are hard to reverse. So the antidote to that is not as available, and sometimes it's extremely expensive. One dose to reverse one of those would be, it used to be $22,000 in the US, and now I believe it's $12,000. So just to give you the antidote to reverse the anticoagulant, the newer generation of is extremely expensive. So I would say if anyone wants to take a pre-diving and they're in anticoagulation, consult your physician in person.
Okay, sorry, you just have to back up there a second because you just about made my mind explode. You're saying that
I'm sorry.
The problem that you could have because of the anticoagulant can be fixed with a simple medication or procedure, but this procedure or medication costs upwards of $22,000.
Yeah, for some of them. Yeah, for some of them. If you arrive in a hospital,
how is this possible? Sorry, you know, for those of us in the non-American, we know the American health system is a fucking insane kind of space compared to the rest of the world. But is that just a drug company that marks up the price because it's something that they don't sell so much of, or how can it be possible that a drug could cost $22,000 for one dose?
Oh boy, you're asking me to cross a fine line. You're asking me to discuss healthcare. but that's a big topic.
Healthcare. We'll do healthcare, and then we'll do guns, and then we'll do abortion. Let's just get it all out on this episode.
Wow. Yeah.
No.
I can't speak
back
for
up,
that.
Back up.
But it's fine. So my concern is, I just want to limit what I speak of in regards to the medical part, because that's what I know. I will say I know well. And if someone is taking up free diving, you're putting yourself at risk to a degree. For the most part, it's an extremely safe sport, especially if you're doing it on a training camp or a competition. Is probably the safest place to have an incident. But if you are taking up freediving and you are taking anticoagulants for anything, some of them are cheap and some of them are quite easy to reverse, like aspirin, for example. You give a medication, you get a quick transfusion, and the effect is reversed and it's relatively cheap and available. If you're put on another blood thinner, a newer generation, the antidote for that, or let's say the reversal agent, it can be very expensive. And yes, up until recently, one of them was about $22,000 per package.
Okay.
I don't know why and how. I cannot tell you the intricacies of why, layman terms. And it's a well-known medication to be used in hypertension. It's been used for decades.
Yeah, that's the subject that we won't obviously try to step into, not understanding enough about that subject. But so you've mentioned a few different kinds of medications here that new divers or current divers will have to be aware of or should be aware of, like diuretics, beta blockers, alpha blockers you mentioned. Could you just explain very briefly what the difference is between a beta blocker and an alpha blocker, since I'm not entirely sure myself?
Yeah. So a beta blocker is a medication that acts on a beta receptor and most importantly has been used for decades, many decades, for hypertension to decrease your heart rate and also decrease the amount of pressure by which the heart is pumping blood. One of the potential side effects is bradycardia, which is low heart rate, which sometimes can cause loss of consciousness, and also hypotension, lower blood pressure. So that's a concern when you're diving, obviously, because you will induce even potentially more bradycardia with dive reflex. Now, alpha blocker acts on the alpha receptor, and alpha receptor stimulates vasoconstriction. An alpha blocker will be acting against vasoconstriction, and then potentially acting against the dive reflex, because we depend on peripheral vasoconstriction. So the alpha blocker will act against that. So that would be my concern.
Are there any you're talking about medications here? Are there also any supplements, maybe more common supplements that might be available over the counter or through supplement websites and things like that, that could also be of concern? Like, for example, I often use NAC, N-acetylcysteine. I think that it has benefits for my lung health, as somebody that has some issues with my lung health and sort of like, you know, been diagnosed at one point actually with early stage COPD. So hopefully free diving is keeping that at bay. But I also hear that it's a bit of a blood thinner as well. Is there anything else like that that people might be taking, thinking it's completely benign, but perhaps might not be so?
In surgery, we worry quite a bit about blood anticoagulation. So I always ask my patients to avoid taking fish oil and vitamin E. Sometimes there's reports of, I believe, ginkgo biloba, those three, but mainly fish oil and vitamin E, because lots of people take that, and you don't want to be taking that while you're having major surgery or just after surgery, because there's an effect described of increase in bleeding time. So I would be careful with that, especially perhaps if you're just doing dynamics and your risk of bio trauma is extremely low, and perhaps it's not a concern, but if you're going deep, many atmospheres, and your risk of bio trauma is higher or tracheal squeeze is higher or sinus squeeze, then yes, I would be concerned about taking those supplements.
Okay, so on the subject of these medications that people have to look out for, what is then your plan or your suggestion to increase awareness for people coming into the sport? Because at the moment we have our, in IDA, for example, you have your medical form that you have to fill out in the beginning of the course. Do you think that is adequate heads up, let's say, or do we need to give people more information?
I feel that that form is as good as you would expect for now, because it's asking you for the obvious issues that you want to catch. And the form is a statement. It's a statement for the obvious medical contraindications, not all contraindications. It's important to know that that doesn't mean the form is a self-assessment by the diver and self-reporting of your issues and recent past medical issues or past surgical issues. But the physician who signs that form may not be aware of occult medical conditions. I think it's good to look at your medical background from the surface, but there are conditions that may be missed, like occult PFO or occult COPD or occult arrhythmia. You may not have ever been diagnosed with that. Therefore, you won't report that. Therefore, the physician may not even know you have it and still have a signed medical statement. So it's important to know the medical statement doesn't guarantee that you don't have any occult medical issues. But I think moving forwards, as free diving becomes more of a, if you will, a mainstream sport perhaps, or more popular, I feel like if you are about to start free diving, visit your primary care physician in person. And ideally someone that knows about diving. And for that, you can call Dan, Divers Network, to ask for a physician close by that knows about it. But I feel like there's nothing that can replace meeting with a physician face-to-face. That's the gold standard.
Right. So as well as having the medical form, obviously, you know, usually given the first day that you sit down to do your course, you know, there could be a general recommendation in the lead up to the course for the student to visit their general practitioner and have a good thorough check over, just as to be a little bit preemptive in the case there's something that had been missed before, right?
Yes, and if you'd like to find it's a pretty comprehensive list of relative and absolute contraindications for freediving, you can go to the AIDA website. There's a document published in May 25th, 2021, and a group of us put together a recommended list of contraindications from medications to pulmonary, neurological, cardiovascular conditions. And that's sort of like a guide for perhaps the instructor or event organizer to look at it and see, sort of gauge if someone should be diving or not. Ultimately, I believe for an event is the organizer's decision, and for a course is the instructor's judgment to allow somebody to take a course. That list, that document is you can find it at the medical at AIDA, AIDAinternational.org. And it also serves a purpose to primary care physicians to guide yourself and sort of gauge if somebody comes to your clinic and says, can I free dive? Lots of physicians will not even know what that is. So, that's a public document you can find it online.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about long barrel trauma or squeeze, as well as the medications that we've talked about that could be having an effect on somebody's on their condition after they squeeze or before they squeeze. What about, I mean, we all know, we teach as instructors how to avoid squeeze, what the main reasons for squeeze happening is, you know, like tension, bad body position, diving outside of your limits, things like this. But are there any pre-existing medical conditions that can make long barrel trauma more likely, in your opinion?
Perhaps, yes. So I would say heart failure, Now, the chances of having heart failure can I'm not a cardiologist, I have to disclose that. So, but I know that heart failure can increase pressures on your pulmonary system and decrease the ability of your heart to drain your pulmonary vasculature. So if you have pulmonary hypertension, like there's a medical term called cor pulmonale, when the pressure in your pulmonary vein and artery are increased. So that potentially could be a higher risk for lumbar trauma, because there's, so for lung issues in freediving, it's either pulmonary edema or lumbar trauma. And there's sort of an spectrum in between. And it's really hard to know sometimes what is what. If you have a diver coming up from, let's say, 60 meters, and immediately within the next 60 seconds upon surfacing, you ask him to just chat, you'll see somebody probably taking a couple deep breaths and catching their breath for probably 30 to 60 seconds and then be completely fine. And that may be potentially just immersion pulmonary edema that clears out with every heartbeat for the next couple minutes. But then that's one end of the spectrum, and the other end is actually lumbar trauma, where it's not just excess of fluid on your tissues, but actually fluid on your alveoli. And the spectrum is anything in between. So anything that will impair the ability of your heart to clear out venous drainage from your lungs can potentially be a higher risk for lumbar trauma, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was just speaking to the doctor who was taking care of the research study that was done on a group of us freedivers during the pre-competition here in March in preparation for the Taiwanese Freediving Cup. And the results of that test or that research is sort of like coming in now, and he has some preliminary results and things that we also knew at the time, like from looking at the lung ultrasounds. We had lung ultrasounds done the night before the dives. We had lung ultrasounds done immediately after we came out the water after the dive the next day. So, you know, the main takeaway that I'm going to do an interview with him also, but the main takeaway from this that I think is important for the listeners to know is that signs of fluid in the lungs, or you know, a change in the lungs that is like a pathological change in the condition of the lungs, let's say, I hope I'm using the terminology correctly, is much more common than people might expect. And in, I think something like 50% of the divers who were examined, about 50% of them were showing signs of edema in the lungs after their dives. And even in dives as shallow as 47 meters, I think was the shallowest one. And although many of them were presenting symptoms, many of them were not presenting symptoms as well. You know, some people come out the water with very low oxygen saturation, but otherwise feel completely fine. Some people have completely normal oxygen saturation, but they have very clear these B lines or lung comets in their lungs in the ultrasound after they've been examined. Mm. So it's important for divers to know that a lung squeeze is not just something where you pop out of the water and you're coughing up blood, or you have a tightness in the chest, or that you feel bad, but we can and probably are causing a certain degree of stress or even damage to the lungs many times when we don't even realize it. And I think the point here is that learning how to manage our diving in the most responsible way to avoid this escalating out of control and having very serious lung barrel trauma is the key, right? It's a kind of tricky thing.
Yeah. So this is interesting you bring that up. I've been working with very good freediver and physician, Biso Silva from California, and a great guy. And we're trying to think about, we're thinking about this, putting this protocol together to do ultrasound on freedivers and trying to differentiate between when those B lines are present, meaning if they're present only when there's no symptoms or symptoms or blood hemoptysis, or just speeding up blood, or when it's perhaps normal in patients and divers that are asymptomatic, have no symptoms. So that's coming up. And yeah, I feel like the what I could, if anybody asks me what's the best way to stay safe from that, is to know your own body, because you only know how you feel inside in regards to your breathing and what's the effort you need to take for each breath. And if you, let's say you do a PB of X amount of meters, and right after your PB, and you've consistently been doing that, and you feel this certain way, meaning you take this certain effort to take each breath, let's say for the next 15 minutes after that dive, that shouldn't change in time. That shouldn't get worse with time. I should get either the same or better, ideally, correct, in our freediving bank of knowledge. But if you're doing the same dive and you're having severe difficulty breathing after the same dive, then that's a concern. That's a red flag. If you're desatting below 93, perhaps at rest after the same dive, it's a point of concern. If you're in the pulse ox and you're satting above 93% at rest, but then you walk and let's say you go to the mailbox and back and you're dropping to the 80s or 90, then that's a concern too. So that's a mini test to test a diver if to compare saturation at rest versus at a mild activity like walking or even going up and down the stairs. So I feel like monitoring your own yourself and the way you feel is probably the safest way to stay away from having repetitive lung injury. Because the ultrasound is not going to be available for everyone. Let's be you know, honest. And you won't have a medical person on site all the time either. So the best way to, in my mind, to keep the community safe is to try to teach medical knowledge to a degree to all the community, so it's available for everyone for free. And that's the best way to have to keep everyone safe.
Yeah.
I mean, I really care about freediving. So I feel like, if you don't mind me interrupting, I feel like the freediving community is more scientific than not. And all of us read scientific papers more so than not, than other sports. So I feel like making that knowledge available to everyone for free is what should be done.
Yeah, for sure. And it was super interesting in that couple of month period leading up to the competition that I was kind of self-monitoring very carefully my own condition as I dived. You know, I was moving from the 50s into the 60s and then into the 70s, and they were all new depths for me. So I'd be carrying the pulse oximeter with me. I'd be checking each day in the before I dived, I'd be checking immediately after the dive, and then I'd be checking later on in the day, just out of curiosity. And it was interesting, a couple of things that came up. With the lung ultrasound, what was interesting was that they found a beeline on the night before the dive. And I think that he said that we needed like three for it to really be clinically significant, but still it was there. And then when I came out the water after the dive, it was only like 60 meters, so it wasn't a huge dive for me. But my lung was clearer, actually, after the dive than it was the night before. So you can see that, well, it's hard to see, but what I'm speculating here, I can speculate more than you because I'm not a doctor, so I'll speculate, is that it's, you know, my lungs are kind of, our lungs are always in a kind of a state of trying to reach the equilibrium and trying to come back to the normal healthy state. And the night when I had the lung ultrasound, that day I had done some pretty deep diving. So maybe there was something sort of left over from the dive before. But the next day, maybe the combination of the rest plus the easy dive was almost therapeutic to my lungs in some way. And I noticed in terms of the pulse oximetry, I would notice that my oxygen saturation was always really high when I came out the water, no matter how deep the dive I had done. But there were a couple of days where I did feel a heaviness in my chest, but I'd only feel it several hours later, maybe, you know, like 3 or 4 hours later. And then I checked my pulse oximetry and it would be sort of like in the 94 to 95 range, and it would stay that way for a few hours, and then it would kind of come back to normal. So, of course, I can't see inside my lungs. I don't know what is happening there, but we can, if we do check like that, we can combine that with our physical sensations, with what we feel inside our body, and be intelligent and smart about how we feel, and say, okay, maybe tomorrow is a good day to have a rest, or maybe even have a couple of days rest, and things like this.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned the symptoms were a little bit worse hours after the dive. I feel like the number one, I mean, I feel like, yeah, monitoring your own health and your own symptoms and how you feel is the safest way to stay away from trouble. And not that I can do it all the time. I'm like probably the worst example to do that, since I've had my fair share of, it's my mea culpa, my fair share of accidents from doing stupid stuff, right? So I'm glad I learned from my mistakes. In lumbar trauma, I feel like the first, and I can, and this is just my own, this is a one man opinion, okay? And clinically, I feel like lumbar trauma to a degree is worse, perhaps a couple of hours or some hours after the incident, not immediately after the incident. Especially if you, because there's got to be some degree of inflammation cascade that gets triggered with the bar trauma, and the lung edema is worse. I made a mistake once that I had a lung squeeze in Curacao, and I felt much worse 6 hours after the event than before. I mean, I don't know how to explain that, but I feel like your body just tries to, there's got to be some inflammation or some cascade of pulmonary edema that happens after, as a consequence of the bar trauma. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. It's worse after.
Yeah, and in my case, and I think this will probably resonate with a lot of freedivers, is I've never really had a very explicit lung squeeze. I've never said I've had a lung squeeze. I've never felt like I've had a lung squeeze. I never had tightness in the chest. I never produced any blood. I never felt like something had happened. Like the symptoms that I'm describing were only a very, like a low level kind of like nagging sensation that perhaps I would have ignored if I was busy with something else. So I think there's a lot of cases like that where you might be going about your business, and well, that's the thing. We don't know what is happening inside. So the more information that we can gather through increasing the amount of ultrasounds that are done, increasing the amount of self-monitoring that's done, increasing the amount of studies that are done in this subject, just helps to, you know, fill up that library of information that we can look at, and it helps us to understand what is going on inside our own body.
Yeah, freediving is... It's growing, and it's always, I feel like it's better to have the right questions rather than the right answers, because we don't have all the answers, obviously.
So freediving safety is an area absolutely as close as possible to my heart. I believe that freediving is fundamentally an incredibly safe sport. A lot of people have this idea that it's an extreme and dangerous sport. It is not, does not have to be. All that is required is that you understand the basics of freediving safety protocols and practices and rescues and things like that. If you would like to learn the basics for free, it's not a substitute for a course, but it is a good refresher for those who have done a course, or for those people who refuse to do a course because they think they don't need it, then you should check out freedivingsafety.com. Here's a little message from Ted Harty, who will explain all about that.
We've all heard it before, but I don't push myself. I know my limits. I've never had a problem before. Like many of you, I've spent countless hours on the internet trying to educate people about safe freediving practices, as well as implore them to take a freediving course. This is what led me to create freedivingsafety.com. I wanted to create an online resource that any freediver could instantly access to learn how to dive safely from a trusted and reliable source at no cost to them. My name is Ted Harty. I'm the founder of Immersion Freediving and my new podcast, Freedive Live. My deepest dive is 279 feet or 85 meters, and I'm an instructor trainer for performance freediving. A freediving course, 100%, is the best way to gain this knowledge. But what about someone where the nearest instructor is 500 miles away, or they can't afford a course, or they can't get time off work? I never liked the idea that this critical safety information is locked behind the paywall of a freediving course. In my online course, you will learn every single thing that I teach my students with regards to freediving safety, including how to save your buddy's life if they have a blackout. Dive safe out there. It's not even that hard, especially when you can learn for free at freedivingsafety.com.
All right, let's get back to Wani.
You also mentioned here your thoughts on, you wanted to talk about your thoughts on the best way to do training. Did we cover that before, or were there some other points that you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I'd rather not. I definitely cannot tell you the best way to do training because that's, I'm trying to determine myself that still. I'm still working on that very much, and I'd rather leave that to much higher level athletes. All I can tell you is the same medical part, same medical sermon, look at your past medical history, look at your medications. If you have recent history, that's important. And that's something that I got more interested by listening to Jerome Van Hout from Belgium. He brought a very good point of looking at what has happened to a diver in the last 3 months. If there's a recent history of barotrauma that is reported to an event or a training camp or a course, then you have to look at that. If there's been a barotrauma perhaps a year prior, then it may not be a big deal. But if there's been a severe barotrauma within the last 3 months or the last month, then yes, then that's a concern. And that's something that was brought up by him, and I have to give credit to that. So I feel that's a very good point.
Okay. Shout out to Jeroen. Look, Jani, the thing is, when it comes to lung injury, of course, if we go back to 2013, we have this tragic incident with Nick Mavoli. The exact reasons for that, let's not go into that, but we know that he had a history of lung injury. He was talking about it. People were observing it. I mean, obviously something really terrible and tragic happened there, but to my knowledge, I haven't heard about many people having such severe lung injuries that it debilitates them or puts them out of free diving permanently. I haven't heard about that very, very many times, maybe one or two anecdotal cases. Is that something that is happening more often than we think? Or am I correct in thinking that people tend to heal from these bad squeezes most of the time, almost all of the time?
I haven't seen every single case, obviously, and I haven't heard anyone to be permanently impaired from diving from having a lumbar trauma. No, I have not.
Okay.
I have not been aware of that. So on the same boat.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about care after lung barotrauma. You had some thoughts on a self-test to determine, when is the right time or a good time to return to diving after a squeeze. You hear all different kinds of numbers from people from, 3 days to 6 months. Spend any time training in a place where people are doing deep free diving, you see people squeezing. Sometimes you see people squeezing considerably and then you see them in the water again the next day. That's that is a fact about the free diving community that I'm not going to sugarcoat. So what are your thoughts on how we can actually determine when the right time or a good time is to go back to depth?
Yeah, well, underreporting perhaps is quite common in our community, and I'm not excluding myself. I would, if I felt a little funny or wrong, and I may want to block that out of my mind just to be able to dive the next day. Yeah. So the ideal scenario, okay, there's two scenarios. If you're, let's say, in a big city and you have lumbar trauma because you went to the spring or you went to the beach or the ocean, then if you're really concerned about your symptoms, let's say you go to the ER or a hospital, any hospital, you get a chest x-ray and it looks perhaps questionably abnormal, perhaps not too bad. And then they get a chest CT, which the ideal test for that is called chest CT thin cuts without contrast, lung window. And then you see some edema, it's like cotton ball-like pattern of edema. So the ideal scenario will be for you to get your good lung auscultation, pulmonary function test, and then rest for X amount of time, let's say 3 or 4 weeks, and then repeat those tests and you see that everything is normalized. And then to a certain degree of certainty, you can say, I'm almost back to normal, it's safe to go back. And I feel like the reintroduction to depth should be gradual. Not that I have a big opinion on how to do training myself, but I feel like from the medical standpoint, you should reintroduce yourself to depth slowly. If your PB is, 80 something meters, then you should start with 5, 10, 15, 20, meters each day if you had a bad case of pulmonary barotrauma. And then see how you feel and take your pulse ox after every session. And your body will tell you, according to your symptoms and your pulse oximetry, if your progression is too fast or adequate, right? If you're doing 10 meters today and then 40 meters tomorrow and then 50 meters the next day as a progression, and you feel like your difficulty breathing is significant each day and it's in crescendo, then yes, probably too fast. I hope that makes sense. I feel like it's a tailored approach per diver. Yeah. And the other end of the spectrum is if you're in a remote area with no access to x-rays, no access to CAT scans, only with your pulse oximeter that most free divers have, then I feel like, again, there's some guidelines published by ADA Medical about that, but I feel it's like a judgment call. If your symptoms were severe, then you have to rest until, number one, your saturation is normal. You don't have any difficulty breathing at rest, definitely not rest, and definitely not doing a light activity like a light jog or going up and down the stairs or just going for a light jog for 10 minutes. You shouldn't be exhausted and you shouldn't be having difficulty breathing with that either if that's not your baseline. And then the reintroduction should be slow as well. And I feel like if you want to do some tests and dry, perhaps you can do just dry statics, just go slow, dry full lung statics obviously first, and then potentially if your baseline is used to doing XL statics, then you can do XL statics to a degree and see how your body feels, because then you're simulating going to depth. You don't want to go to depth and just find out at depth that you're not feeling well. Does that make sense? You want to try to do statics on Excel and sort of guesstimate that that's how you will feel at depth, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, I mean, I just released last week a new video on the YouTube channel, advanced stretching and equalization routine that I use myself with, it's call it advanced because we're simulating empty lung breath holds using the Pilates ball with the thoracic spine curving stretched over the ball with manipulating under the ribs and stuff like that. So I think, something like that yeah. Which I never recommend. I personally never recommend doing something like that as a warm up for a diving session. I consider it to be almost a substitute for a diving session, and especially useful right. to people who don't have access right. to the water. But that might be for somebody who has right. suffered from a situation like this. That might be something to work up towards, and because you're on dry land, you can pay very careful attention to the sensations that you feel, and if you feel anything out of sorts, then it might be an indication that you're not ready to go back to the water or something like that, right?
100%. That's 100%. I 100% agree with that. Yeah, I know what you're saying, that the backward stretching, sort of like hyperextension on exhale and you know, touching the rib cage and the front. Yes. And then stretching on the physio ball. It's usually that 55-centimeter physio ball is that the one I use, or the TRX ball. Doing that prior to testing how you feel at depth will be probably better and safer. And I do have to say, if you are doing breath hold like that at home on dry, number one, try not to use facial gear. And if you do facial gear, mask or a nose clip, try to have somebody at home, because there's risk associated with that. If you become hypoxic, God forbid, and you have a nose clip, that's concerning. You may not recover.
Yeah, I put an explicit warning about the nose clip in that video, because I'm not sure if it was you that I was talking to, but we did have a discussion with somebody about a case of a diver who blacked out on an RV dive with a nose clip on, and for whatever reason, the mouth was locked. They didn't open the mouth to breathe, and it caused quite a severe lung injury. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's a case report that we put out last year. A diver that was very gracious to contribute to the collective knowledge. I feel like that's important. So yeah, a lot of new things coming up, and the more we investigate, the more we realize we don't know. You know, that's free diving for you. The more we learn, the less we know.
One more thing on the subject of lung barrel trauma, Wani, is, you know, what general recommendations? I know everyone gets these recommendations, should get these recommendations usually on a level 2 course, like an IDA 3 or a Molchanov's wave 2 or whatever it is. But in terms of the, you know, management and self-care after a lung barrel trauma or a suspected lung injury, what are your top recommendations there?
Good question. So if there's any pulmonary symptoms and you may think that you have lung barrel trauma, meaning you feel maybe the taste of blood, even if you're not spitting out blood, if you feel the taste of blood, you feel like you may be bleeding, even slightly, try to avoid, if you have pain on top of that, try to avoid aspirin or any NSAID, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, meaning ibuprofen, Motrin, naproxen, all the family of ibuprofen, naproxen, Aleve, etc. Because that can help with pain, even muscle pain, but that can trigger more bleeding. And that's very, very important. And I see that from the surgical world, where if somebody takes it right after surgery, you will see, almost invariably, you will see bleeding. You will see a hematoma or fluid collection that happens. So try to avoid those medications after a suspected lumbar trauma.
Right. Another this is a one very is, good point, Wani. Sorry to interrupt you on that go point, ahead. But that's go an ahead. Excellent point, because as a surgeon, you open people up and you see this acting out right in front of your face as a result of taking these medications. But a lot of people who you know, sometimes I take an ibuprofen just because, you know, like I bump my knee on the edge of a table or something like that. But also, like, I might have the feeling like, oh, I'm feeling a little bit off today, I'll take an ibuprofen because it's anti-inflammatory, therefore anti-inflammatory is good, etc., etc. So, you know, I know that's not smart, but that's the kind of, you know, the way my mind works sometimes. And I think a lot of people are like that. It's that they might reach for that ibuprofen or paracetamol or whatever it is just because they feel like they have to take something, when really it could be counterproductive to their healing process.
There's no hard and fast rule for this. Yes, I mean, I think taking ibuprofen the night before a dive session may be totally irrelevant and maybe uneventful. But if you know you may have an injury, a current injury now after a diving session, I would stay away from those medications, especially aspirin and the NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. You know, it's obviously important to always consult with a physician if you are unsure what medications you should take. If you have severe pain from another type of injury while after that diving session, then sometimes a metal dose pack, which is a short course of steroids, can help. Now, obviously, this is not what you should be doing before a competition, because that can you know, that can affect your results if you're tested. Tylenol is the one medication that is not considered per se to increase bleeding time, at least in the surgical knowledge. I don't mind if patients have been taking Tylenol, but if a patient has taken one ibuprofen within, I don't know, 5 days before surgery, I just don't do it if it's elective.
Really? That's strong. Huh?
Yeah, you won't. Yes, wow. Yes, I will not do it. If it's elective, meaning you're electing to have something, it's not an emergency. And if it's an emergency, yes, you run the risk, you give medications, transfusion, and take a patient to the OR to save a life. But if it's an elective surgery, yeah, I would not recommend taking any aspirin, ibuprofen, or fish oil, vitamin E the week before an elective surgery, and it's more unlikely to be canceled. Wow. If that's the case.
That's
how important I feel about those medications.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And for Tylenol is what we call in Europe acetaminophen or paracetamol. Correct. Right?
Right. And that helps with pain and inflammation.
Yeah, fever reduction and things like that.
Right. And obviously don't take Tylenol with alcohol. Yeah.
So you wanted to also you had a note here about the visual difference in symptoms between DCE and AGE. So I mean, both those terms might be a little bit technical for people. So if you just break down what you mean by that and why that's relevant to free divers, and what are the visual differences in symptoms?
So DCI is decompression illness, which is the sort of the big group of conditions that happen when there's changes in bubble size upon ascent, and then it can be separated between decompression sickness, which is type 1, type 2, and then separately arterial gas embolism. Arterial gas embolism is when there's a bubble that travels through an artery and produces symptoms of stroke potentially, and that usually when it's described in the literature to cause symptoms right upon surfacing. However, decompression sickness, which is increase in size on nitrogen bubbles in tissue, not necessarily inside a vessel, can have symptoms not immediately after the dive, but perhaps 5-10 minutes after the dive. Does that make sense?
Hmm. Yeah.
So two different clinical presentations. Now both will respond to recompression, to chamber compressions, chamber treatment, if it's done fast enough, and if it's number one, if it's identified fast enough, and then if it's treated fast enough.
So what are the, when you talk about visual differences in symptoms? Sorry if I just missed that there, but is there something that you can see from looking at the patient if you're like untrained, for example, that tells you where they're at with that?
It's not really. I would say when I say visual, it's when you see from when you're looking at a diver on a trend in the 10 minutes after a dive or 15 minutes after a dive, you see a diver coming up and having symptoms immediately, let's say blindness or hemiparesis or inability to move one side of the face, then that could be, it's likely arterial gas embolism. And then if that happens, so say 5 minutes, 10 minutes after the dive, when the diver is resting, then it's more likely to be decompression sickness. Now, there's no relevance in treatment because both of them have to be identified and have to be treated fast, if that makes sense. That's probably a red herring, but at least to me, it's interesting to be able to differentiate both of them.
Wani, in your time as in doing what you do, but also as a competitive free diver, somebody who's been around the free diving scene and a lot of deep divers, do you see, obviously divers are getting deeper, but do you see a lot of people with symptoms of decompression illness? Have you seen a lot of that? Have you often seen people have to go to the chamber?
I don't think anyone can say they've seen a lot of DCS cases in freediving because there have not been a lot per se. And a lot meaning a couple, you know, like 10 or 20 cases, but yeah, I've seen a fair share of them. And you only can take away what happened, what influenced the event and how to prevent it. And, you know, thank God that, the few cases I've seen, have done relatively well, all things considered, because they're not just patients that I see in a clinic. They're like my family and my friends, and I deeply care about that. So, I wouldn't say I've seen a lot, but I would say that if you've seen someone have neurological symptoms, and they just came up from ascended from depth, yeah, most likely a decompression illness, decompression sickness.
Yeah, I don't know what you would say to this, but you know, if I had to give a recommendation, we've seen a couple of high profile cases of you know, deep divers who have suffered from decompression related incidents and the aftermath of that. But I also know anecdotally of somebody who ended up in a chamber because they did 2 60-meter dives in one day with, you know, a short interval between them. The other factors that contributed to that, I don't know. Again, it's all completely anecdotal, but at the end of the day, what was really important was that this person had insurance and that they were able to call up Dan and they were able to get into a chamber and be looked after. So, you know, I'm heading off to Dahab next week. I don't have regular health insurance, but I got my diving insurance. I got my Dan, and that really puts my mind at rest. It's something that just makes sure that you have that, because you don't know what condition you're in, like how susceptible you are to these things, what other factors are all going to come together to you know, possibly lead to this kind of thing happening. And yeah, a decompression chamber is not a cheap thing to have to go and spend a bunch of time in, right?
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point. Having Dan insurance is a great thing, and Dan or Dan Europe, they're great. Great agencies that very responsive. You have to make sure that if God forbid something like that happens to you, and you are really concerned about potential DCI, DCS, and you feel like you may need to go to a chamber, yes, you call Dan. You need to see a doctor on site, though, somebody that will diagnose you with that, who actually give a statement that you need to be evacuated. That's important, because any insurance company will ask for that, not just Dan, or any evacuation company will want the statement of a physician on site or a medical personnel on site that will indicate the need to evac. So that's something important. And you have to obviously make sure you keep track of your medical tests. If you get a brain MRI or chest CT, you have to keep not only the written report, but the CDs with the actual images for your own records, because you want to see that over time. And if you get an MRI, let's say a year after, or a CT a year after, then you want to compare apples to apples. So it's important to keep your medical records with you, especially if you are, you know, in remote areas or foreign countries that where you're not used to being. So, but yeah, having that insurance is crucial. Yeah, great thing to have.
All right, Wani, before we finish up here, there's just another topic that I wanted to just throw out there. It's a little bit of a controversial one, but I'm not sure if you're aware of the recent, let's say, situation with Matt Malina, the so-called doping scandal, and the use of beta blockers at the FASA competition and all this kind of thing. And then we also have William Troubridge proposing the Union of Free Diving Athletes as an organization to look more closely into the possibility of doping in the free diving competition scene. Do you have any thoughts or comments on this? Are you, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot. Do you have suspicions that?
Thank you.
Do you have suspicions that doping is of some description is more common or than we think in free diving, or do you think the suspicions are unfounded? Do you have any thoughts on that? And what kind of medications?
Ah, no. Jeez, I don't know.
All right, this is outside of the scope of your what you want to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's okay. But I can tell you that I definitely have. If I don't know something well, I'd rather not say it. If what I'm going to say is not better than silence, I'd rather not say anything. Yeah. So I have nothing really to say about that situation. But, you know, human nature is, I mean, we all share the same, this is to a degree, a same range of modus operandi. And we all try to, if we want to have a nice deep dive session, then we all try to take whatever will help us. And I'm not saying that we all try to do doping or anything, but we all try to sleep well and maybe take ibuprofen the day before, maybe some iron pills to make sure your hemoglobin is not bad. And and just, you know, turn off the AC. I mean, we all do this, all these little things to make sure our diving is perfect and enjoyable. So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't have an opinion about doping. I do have an opinion about the union of freediving. How do you call it? The union?
I think it's the Union of Freediving Athletes. Union of Freedivers. I think it's the proposed name. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's great. I definitely support it. I definitely support it. I feel like it's a great initiative. 100%. I mean, because it seems to be leveling out the field so that everyone trains and competes under the same circumstances, all even, with no inequality or advantageous circumstances for one end or another. So yeah, I would definitely support that. I would support that for sure.
The ultrasound machine, that's what it was. I was thinking about this because we were talking about expensive things. You know, this doctor came to the island and he had his laptop and we're doing the lung ultrasounds with the laptop and this little dongly thingy that he was using for that. And I was like, this is awesome, man. Like, I really want to get one of these. If I get one of these, I'm going to go out and start doing lung ultrasounds on everybody, you know, whether they even like it or not. How much do they cost? It was like $10,000 for this thing that he was using. $10,000 almost. Can you get anything cheaper than that?
Yeah, there's a good product that I don't you know, I don't have anything to do with that company, but it's a good product called Butterfly IQ, and that's that connects to your iPhone, and it's about $2,500, I believe, or $2,800.
Okay, so it's still very expensive, so but it's within reasonable range for the average.
Yeah, I would say
human being at some point in their lives. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you could kind of raise money for to get for a group or something like that. You know, if you had a group of free divers or if you have a school or something like that, you could, you know, possibly raise the funds for that. I wouldn't go out and buy one for myself, but $2,500 is a little bit more realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I feel like the sport is going to grow. We're going to have more tools, more toys to diagnose or prevent. I'm really looking forward to see how freediving is going to pan out in the next 5 years and what new topics are going to come up. But I feel like prevention is one of them, and awareness of your own medical history is another one.
So, Wani, what in terms of, obviously you're very busy being a neurosurgeon and then busy being a diver. In terms of this free diving medicine thing, what's coming up in the future? What are your plans? What do you personally plan to be doing to contribute to this area in the coming years?
I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing for a while, which is trying to assist my community of free divers as my own family. And if anybody has a question for regarding any medical issues related to free diving, I'll be happy to help. You know, I cannot personally give medical advice, but I can give you some medical guidance about where to go, who to talk to, or I can refer you to a specialist that I may not have any connection to, but still you have to go to whoever expert you need. I put together this this company called Freediving Medical and Safety Consultants, and the idea is to streamline the consultation for free divers around the world, for medical issues and just to try to make it more accessible. The more I study healthcare and I learn about freediving, the more I realize that it's hard for our community to have access to healthcare, let alone have insurance, let alone have healthcare coverage, you know, especially in remote areas. So I feel like having access to someone that can answer a question and is knowledgeable and or knowledgeable to a degree, not 100%, it's always useful. I feel like it's what I would expect if I was in not in the medical field. Just as important is for me, it's just as important to have somebody have their questions answered in regards to the medical part or what medications to take or not to take. It's just important as me, for example, asking somebody about training, for example, or about what not to do in a dive. So that's kind of how I learned freediving, asking here and there. And I really have, I think that there's a value in that. So giving that kind of service to my fellow freedivers, to me, is just an honor and pleasure. That's what I plan to do.
So this company that you set up, do you have a website for that? Is that a place where people can go and get started if they need to get in contact with somebody?
I don't have the website now. No. It's coming up. Just in development. And it's me and a small group with other safety divers that are consulting on the matter, but not yet, but I'll get it to you as soon as I get it.
Okay. Yeah. Obviously you keep us up to date on these subjects. I really enjoyed what we did with the study, Wani, you came on, we went into that in depth. I really want to have you back and do more of those when you have more to offer. So I'm sure we're going to be hearing from you again. We started this interview at 8 o'clock in the morning where you are, but you said you were driving back home. Were you coming from work at 8 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, no, I had to go make rounds today at 5 a.m. I came back and I'm still in my scrubs. That's why you see me wearing this ugly green outfit. So I go make rounds with my patients and then I come home. I was supposed to go diving today, but as you can see, there's a bunch of rain and wind. Yeah. And apparently the spring is closed today, so I'm going to have to settle and go to the pool or maybe go to the gym or something.
All right, well, that's great. So you didn't come from like an all-nighter. It was just an early start.
Yeah, no, I did not. No, an all-nighter is tough. That really drains me, I tell you. Really.
I bet it does. I mean, we hear horror stories about what you guys have to do in the – as a medical professionals in hospitals. So I was thinking like this guy's so dedicated to freediving that he's willing to come back home in the morning after a night shift and sit down and do this interview with me, then wow. But wow anyway, because you're doing an amazing job, Wani, trying to disseminate this information to the freediving community. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's an honor for me to be able to sit down and share with you my thoughts. And I really care about freediving as a community because I feel like I didn't start freediving as a physician. I started freediving just as a freediver like everyone else. So everyone in the community became, or the people I know became friends and family. So you want the best for them. And that's what I'm doing. I'm here to help anyone that needs any assistance, and it's just a pleasure to be able to share with you. Thank you so much for giving me this time.
No problem. It's absolutely my pleasure. I will put the links to you, because I know that you're very open to people contacting you, so I will put the relevant links in the show notes for this episode so you can get in touch with Wani on the freedivecafe.com website.
That was Wani Valdivia. So yeah, massive thanks to Wani and massive good luck to him with his dives at VB. I wish I could be there. It would be amazing to watch and get a whole sense of the vibe there at the competition. But so far we've been able to watch, maybe about half of it on the live stream. The live stream has not been perfect, as they never are, but we're getting a good dose of VB here in Dahab. If you would like to get in touch with any questions, recommendations, or suggestions of any form, please contact me through either the freedivandthrive.com website contact page, or you can find me on Instagram, freedivandthrive. I'm on Facebook. My name is Donny Mack, D-O-N-N-Y-M-A-C. There's Facebook pages for the podcast. Search for Free Diving Journal and Free Dive Cafe podcasts. You can email me directly, donny@freedivandthrive.com. All right, I'll be back very soon. I think up next, we are going to have on the Free Diving Journal podcast, so the sister podcast, I'm going to be releasing on the one hand, some old training talk episodes from the archive that I never got around to releasing formally. And then also, there will be the second episode of a new video series that I'm doing. This will be coming out on YouTube and the Free Diving Journal podcast. That is the Free Diver Stories series, where I sit down for, 20, 30 minutes and find out somebody's free diving story. All right, I'll be back soon. And until we meet again, dive safe.